Do you have jet lag?
I don't really, no. Yeah. No, I kind of tell my body to be good and, you know, wherever we are, that's the time and just get on with it. I try and sleep. I sleep on the plane.
Oh my God. That's so funny that you can just control time and
well,
space.
I don't say it works 100%, but I haven't felt real jet lag for a long, long time.
Because if you gave into it every time, like every time you felt tired and you thought like, well, in Ireland it's, you know, 1 a.m. I'm just going to bed.
I never think that. I think always forward looking. It's the time they say it is.
Yes.
Pay attention.
Pay attention.
Body, obey me.
It doesn't matter if you're tired. Hello everyone, welcome to Mothers of Invention. I'm a writer, comedian, podcast host. My name is Maeve Higgins and this is a show where you'll meet the most inspirational women around the world bringing the solutions to our climate crisis. It's also the show where I pick up tips about jet lag from my co-host Mary Robinson, who was the first female president of Ireland. You don't want me to go into your whole bio, do you, Mary?
No, not this time.
And do you learn anything from me, Mary?
There was one point on our first session, I think, about podcasts.
Yes. We're a good podcast team and Mary, you are coming along very nicely. I feel like, you know, another few seasons and you can have your own lifestyle podcast just about your hobbies and things. Do you have hobbies? Do you like oversee elections as a hobby?
My hobbies are actually a state secret. I don't disclose them.
State secrets. We have to do an expose podcast about what you get up to.
This week, we're thinking about our beautiful oceans. We're meeting those working on solutions to the damage that carbon dioxide has done to them and exploring their potential to help us produce greener energy and food. And to help us do that, I'm delighted to welcome into the studio our first oceans mother, marine biologist Dr. Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson. She's going to be our resident expert on the show this week and guide us through the topic. So it's not just two Irish women of different generations. It's also an important voice about the ocean.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming into the studio.
I don't know if it's too disappointing, but actually my mother is Irish.
Oh, that's great.
Get her out.
So maybe I'm not qualified to add diversity to the show.
No, absolutely. More than welcome.
That's totally fine. Also, Ireland is an island. Which I always forget about.
Yes.
So is Manhattan, which most people forget about.
I know.
I mean, New York City is actually an archipelago with almost 400 miles of coastline.
So you're a Brooklyn native, is that right, Ayanna?
Born and raised, yeah.
So how does a Brooklynite make her way into ocean conservation?
I fell in love with the ocean when I first went swimming in the Florida Keys. It was like the only family vacation we ever really went on together, all three of us.
Yeah.
And I rode on a glass-bottom boat. And I saw a coral reef for the first time. And I went to an aquarium and I held a sea urchin in my hand. And they have these hundreds of tube feet on the bottom. Yeah. That's how they get around. And just seeing this like weird, amazing alien creature, I just totally fell for the ocean. I was 5. And it was the summer that I learned to swim, too. So I decided I'm going to be a marine biologist because then going to the aquarium and hanging out at the beach will be my job.
Yeah.
And I just have stubborn enough to that I stuck with it. More or less, there's a lot more time doing email than I would maybe like. But, you know, such as modern
life. How could
life.
A 5-year-old know that, though?
I didn't see it coming.
So you're an adjunct professor at NYU.
Yeah, I teach a class there, a seminar course called Urban Ocean Conservation, about how coastal cities can do a better job of doing right by the sea.
Do you actually go down to the shore at all with them?
With the class?
Yeah.
We have one field trip this semester to a wet lab on the Hudson called the River Project, where they'll get to see. There's seahorses that live under piers in the Hudson River.
What?
There's all this. There's whale watching in New York Harbor.
There's seahorses under a pier.
Yeah. There's hundreds of species that live in the waterways of New York.
That is really cool.
They're adorable.
So you founded an ocean collective.
I did. Ocean Collective, it's a consulting firm for ocean conservation strategies that are grounded in social justice. So how can we have both at the same time and make sure we're taking care of coastal communities as we're thinking through what the conservation solutions are? And it's a dozen women who have all sorts of different areas of expertise, from science to education to policy to political strategy to robotics and engineering and communications and film, because all conservation work is inherently multidisciplinary. So I really was excited to build this team with this enormous diversity of skills.
Do you work globally?
Yeah, a lot of our work is sort of general, like doing an assessment of plastic pollution problems and solutions or the seafood supply chain. Right. And some of it is more grounded in a particular place.
I'm so interested in what you said about it being multidisciplinary, because I think with scientists, often you just end up in your own zone and there's so much to study. Like you could literally just look at those seahorses for the rest of your life.
So whether it's plastic pollution or sea level rise or sustainable seafood, there's obviously a scientific component to understanding the problem and then designing the solution. But there's also obviously an economic component. And what would the policy strategy be? And is there a political strategy that's needed? And how do we communicate these ideas well? And do we need to create a film to help explain it? So it's really important to be able to bring all of those skills to the table when we're thinking about these complicated problems and not only what the solutions would be, but how to actually push them forward.
And so when it comes to the sea, like how bad is it? Like what's happening?
So the ocean's been doing a lot of buffering of the things that we've done to the climate system. The ocean has absorbed 90% of the heat that's been excess trapped by greenhouse gases and 40% or so of the carbon dioxide. And so just imagine if the ocean weren't there, how much more of a pickle we'd be in, right? But the problem is that absorbing all this heat and absorbing all this CO2 has actually changed the entire ocean. It's changing the way that currents are flowing. It's changing the actual chemistry of the seawater, the pH. It's becoming more acidic. So ocean acidification is a result of burning fossil fuels, and that has really big implications for the ability of some creatures to grow shells like corals or oysters, and even to smell things, because the water just is a different medium than it used to be.
I was interested that the UN actually had its first major conference on oceans quite recently, just to focus on the issues that you're talking about, including acidification, which is a real problem, and rising sea levels. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, I think people don't really have a good grasp of how big a deal that's going to be, because the majority of people around the world live quite near to the coast.
75 million people live within 1 meter of the sea around the world. 75 million.
Wow.
So any rise and they're affected.
Yeah. In the US, it's about 40% of people who live in coastal counties. And most of those are in cities. And that's why I'm interested in the intersection of ocean conservation and cities right now. But I think in Bangladesh alone, we're expecting to have tens of millions of climate refugees when sea level rises. And it's the kind of thing that people can't get their heads around, because it's such a dramatic shift in the way we use the coast. So it's flooding and inundation of homes, but also the loss of coastal infrastructure. The joke is, which drives me crazy, rich people are like, oh, great, now my property will be beachfront property. Oh, and you say, like, not only does this disregard what's going to happen to people whose first homes and only homes are lost and don't have insurance to rebuild or move, but you've also missed the point that you won't be able to get there because the road will be flooded and the electricity, the power will be out. And so
they'd be like, I have my helicopter.
Yeah.
But you know what was interesting about the way you said it? You said, there will be hundreds of millions of climate refugees when the sea levels rise.
When they rise further.
When they rise further.
Yeah.
So you're not saying if they rise.
Oh, it's a given. We've already baked in so much heat into the system, and the ice at the poles is already melting. And the thing that never gets talked about is that seawater actually just expands when it's heated. So there's so much sea level rise that will happen even if no ice melts, just because it's expanding as the water heats up.
That was something that I didn't understand. Yeah. I thought sea levels were rising because of like melted ice was joining the water.
Mm-hmm. That's part of it, yeah.
But it's also because like warmer water takes up more space.
Thermal expansion.
Thermal expansion.
There you go.
Is that why I feel bloated in the summer?
That's, I don't know.
Could it be those margaritas?
No, so, I mean, this is why we have to stay at the 1.5 degrees of warming. It's between 1.5 and 2 degrees that the worst of this would happen, and probably the Arctic ice as a whole would go. Isn't that right?
I think it's very unlikely that we're going to stay at 1.5 at this point. And so we really need to start thinking about what happens when we hit 2 and beyond that, because we are in a scenario where it's not just a foot of sea level rise that we're expecting. We're expecting like a meter or 2 meters of sea level rise.
Within what time frame?
By the end of this century, and sooner if the ice goes.
No, but this is kind of still business as usual. We have to change. And I think we have to be very clear about that.
Yeah. I mean, New York City with 2 meters of sea level rise, and then you have a storm surge or you have a high tide, we're done. Like, this
That's
is unlivable.
The entire city.
It's the lower half of Manhattan anyway,
and
Brooklyn. Of Brooklyn and Queens. Yeah. It's just so hard to even conceive of that much rise. And I think the ridiculous part of it is this assumption that we can just build a wall and somehow hold back the entire ocean and assume that there's an easy technological solution. Like the entire world could just become a new version of the Netherlands with
the dams everywhere,
fancy gates that hold back the sea. And that's just hubris. It's absurd. We actually do need to move away from the coast for our safety.
So what keeps you going in this? I mean, how do you stay focused on the work, and like what do you do for your own emotional health?
That's a great question and super important. Well, my New Year's resolution, one of them this year, was fewer meetings, more reading, and more baths.
You're such a water baby.
I know. I also, my mother has a farm upstate New York, and I'm up there almost a week every month with really bad internet and no cell phone reception.
And a lot of fresh air.
A lot of fresh air and a few hundred chickens and a stream with a waterfall out back. And so just getting a dose of nature is really important. I live near a park in Brooklyn as well.
I think those of us who are focused a lot on the climate issue need to be aware that it takes its toll, you know, just
Absolutely.
Mentally and in anxiety terms.
I also find dark humor to be really helpful. So I am...
Maeve doesn't understand dark humor at all.
I find birthday parties to be really stressful, but I wanted to see all my friends, and someone reminded me it was my half birthday. So last weekend, I threw myself a half birthday party, which was all my friends meet me at a dive bar at 9 p.m. I'll be there. I'll put $50 in the jukebox. It'll be the best night ever. Because I don't have time to hang out with each of you individually to go for tea and a walk in the park or cook you dinner because hashtag climate crisis.
That's amazing. Did you have a great time?
It was the best.
We should tell all of our mothers of invention about this.
Yes.
Because it's so stressful, but then you just get to say, you get an extra birthday every year because you're doing this work. Invite all your friends.
And then you age more quickly.
Oh, and then you age more
quickly. We're already aging. Might as well celebrate it. Yeah.
So speaking of both islands and rising sea levels, we're now going to hear from our next mother of invention, and he's the second man that we've included on the show since we began. Mohamed Nasheed was the first democratically elected president of the Maldives, one of the small island nations most at risk of sea level rising, and a very impressive leader who did so much to hold the international community to account on climate change. I remember the leadership he gave in Copenhagen at the COP in 2009. He was ousted in a coup in 2012, and he took exile in London, where I actually met him. But he's back there again in the Maldives, and he was barred from running again as president, so he's running as a member of parliament right now for the elections in April. Our producer Namita caught up with Nasheed on the campaign trail in Mali.
No, I'm ready. Let's start. Is sound is okay for you?
It's fine.
Well, The Maldives is a very big ocean state. It's not a small island state. We stretch from up north to south more than 1,000 kilometers. And we are again wide by 600 miles. When we grew up in the Maldives, we had beach, we had the sea, and we went swimming almost every day. And so we grew up with the elements. We grew up with the coral, we grew up with the fish, we grew up with the sea. And then, of course, you would have the dragonflies during the monsoons. And we ran after them. And the butterflies. These islands are right in the middle of the elements. And you can't escape it. We grow up, we live with nature, not against it. I went to do my first degree in Liverpool. It's a port city. And therefore, the Docklands fascinated me. And I thoroughly enjoyed my time there. I had started routinely writing while I was in Liverpool. And when I came back to the Maldives, I started a small magazine with some of the friends and continued writing as a journalist. Our main focus was human rights and corruption and governance. So that was for the liking of the government at that time. We had a dictatorship in the Maldives, which was running strong for many, many, many years, one dictator after the other. And the government deregistered our magazine. And that night, they arrested 270 people, along with that, the whole editorial board. So they arrested me. I was only 22. I had my 23rd birthday in stocks. And I spent after that much of my 20s and all the way up to mid-30s in prison. It was very harsh conditions. And they tortured me twice in solitary confinement. This was all for writing, all for having a newspaper. And then I thought maybe, you know, if I sought election, they might just leave me alone and not arrest me.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mohamed Nasheed, the president of the Maldives.
We won our battle for democracy in the Maldives. I stand before you today as the first democratically elected president in the history of our country. The path to democracy was not straightforward. It was bumpy and full of turns. A year later, and a continent away, we meet here to confront another seemingly impossible task. We are here to save our planet from the silent, patient, and invisible enemy that is climate change.
A president of the Maldives made something of an international name for himself, trying to protect his nation of 1,000 islands from rising sea levels. 2 weeks ago, a different future overtook Nasheed. He resigned from the presidency, saying he was the victim of a coup.
Every single opposition leader finally ended up in jail. I was fortunate to be able to leave. I went to Sri Lanka and then to London. England gave me a refugee passport. It gave me political asylum. You know, living in exile, away from home, away from the people you know, the culture that you are, you always are reminded of home, maybe, you know, a ray of light, a sound, a smell. Anything can take you back to home. And it wasn't easy. I was always very much focused on two things. One was climate change and the other was democracy in the Maldives. And we started getting ready for the elections here that we won in 2018. After winning, I was able to come back to the Maldives, and it was such a happy feeling to touch ground, come back home, see your father, mother, your extended family, your friends, and start life back again.
Nasheed returned home to a hero's welcome today as thousands took to the seas off Male and flooded the streets to welcome him.
Sea level rise is not the immediate issue. Ocean acidification, higher temperatures, and heating, ocean heating up, that is killing the corals. Now, the Maldives is based on coral islands. The geological structure of the Maldives is coral. And if we lose the coral reefs, we will lose the Maldives. So it is very, very important now that we find more resilient coral. Just recently, I went to one of the islands and they wanted me to have a look at a different species of coral. The diver who I've been diving with since school is one of my classmates, but he has decided to live in this far-flung island. I recently visited him and we went diving and we saw this new species of coral. There's no one in the Maldives who has dived to more reefs than he has. And he's saying that there is a specific species of coral that is more resilient to high temperatures. India has as many islands as the Maldives. Now, surprisingly and beautifully, India has implanted so much mangroves recently that bring you shore protection from coastal erosion, flooding, and a whole host of natural disasters that we keep experiencing every day. Now, we want to use the same technology. We want to use the same methods to protect our coastlines. You would see in the Maldives a number of breakwaters around islands. Now, these are built with very heavy engineering, with a lot of rock boulders, imported from all sorts of places. And this technology is actually 1920s and 30s and very obsolete. But continuously, the UN and the World Bank have been advocating these very wrong development concepts and designs. We really need to come up with a new economics and a new thinking on infrastructure. That we can incorporate building a reef, implanting a mangrove to play the part of a breakwater. I have a press conference
Sir, I can follow you with that?
Yeah, you can come. Yeah. You can leave a lot of your stuff here and just take whatever you want.
Well, he seems like such an extraordinary leader. Mary, where...
He really is, mm-hmm. You know. I mean, and it was extraordinary, the leadership he gave at Copenhagen and as a leader again in the Maldives, because it's really important that small islands give leadership and have their voice heard.
These small island states are really on the front lines of a lot of this because they're right there at sea level. The Maldives, as well as a lot of other island states, have played a really incredible leadership role.
Tell us a bit about mangroves. I know how important they are. And I think, again, we're seeing them being eroded, aren't we?
So mangroves are magical. They're trees that live on the coast and they can tolerate salt water. So their roots are directly in salt water. And their roots are kind of like these crazy legs that are above water. And they create this web within which a lot of other species live. And so juvenile fish that then grow up to be really valuable for the fishermen and for food security live in that area. And mangroves can absorb more carbon per kilometer squared than even a rainforest. They're incredibly good at absorbing carbon and sequestering it in the soil. So they're really important as a climate solution. And they also, because they grow along the coast, are really important buffer from storms.
Yeah.
So when you have a storm come through, the places that have mangroves intact fare a lot better. So I'm just enamored with mangroves. They do all of these important things. We should obviously keep them around. And they're quite easy to replant, too. So there's been a big effort to replant
them. So, Ayana, I'm thinking of you as the little five-year-old girl on this glass-bottom boat looking at the coral. Have you been back to the Florida Keys as a grown-up? Is the coral still there?
And it's one of the most damaged reefs in the world. Disease came and wiped out a lot of the corals. Mm-hmm. Overfishing took out a lot of the herbivorous fish that were eating the algae off the reefs and keeping it clean. And so it's one of the saddest looking coral reefs that we have. And at some point you have to think, like, does it classify as a coral reef still? How much coral has to be there for it to be a reef as opposed to, like, formerly known as a coral reef and currently bits of coral?
Is it possible to reseed? Can you do work on bringing back?
Sort of is is the scientific answer. There's definitely a lot of really impressive work going on now with trying to understand how to replant corals, and that can work at a small scale. There are nurseries growing baby corals, which you can then plant out on the reef and help it regrow. They're doing some really interesting genetic work with corals to figure out which types are the most resistant to heat or changes in salinity, and making sure those are the ones that they're sort of supporting and planting. But I mean, think of how big the Great Barrier Reef is.
Yeah.
We can certainly do a lot to protect corals at a small scale, but on a global scale, we actually just need to stop burning fossil fuels. That is the only way to save coral reefs globally.
And was this part of your PhD, or I think you were talking about fish and fishing and coral reef management?
Yeah, I studied fishing. Yes, my dissertation was called Fish, Fishing, Diving, and the Management of Coral Reefs. And I did all this work in the Caribbean, in Curaçao and Bonaire.
How much fun did you have diving during all of this?
You know, it turns out I don't love scuba diving.
Oh, no!
It's like this required doing 200 or 300 scuba dives, testing out a bunch of different trap designs and different reefs and different places, and diving 3 or 4 times a day. And by the third time you put on a wet wetsuit and a salt crystallized on it and you're pulling it up your leg and, like, your knuckles are raw because of the salt is so sharp when it's dry.
Oh.
And you're just like a cranky prune and you're in 80 degree water and you're shivering. I just wasn't that into it at that point.
Yeah.
You now know, like, my dirtiest secret. I learned to dive explicitly because I couldn't hold my breath long enough to count fish to do this research.
Yes.
And I really wanted to understand how to make fishing more sustainable by redesigning fishing gear, fish traps in particular.
Right.
And so I worked with the local fishermen to figure that out. And we designed them with just a simple slot in the corner of the trap that the baby fish and the ornamental species get out. And the fishermen
and the really
make
thin
the
ones.
Same. Yeah. The skinny guys leave that no one's eat anyway. And then the fishermen make the same amount of money while reducing this bycatch by 80%. Mm. So it was a really great win-win situation. And now that's required by law in a bunch of different places. I guess that would be my invention, since I haven't actually invented and birthed a human. I've birthed some other things.
That is the coolest thing. Yeah. And you're not even, like, expected to invent something. You were just studying, and then you were like, hey, look at this.
But the problem of overfishing is a very real problem.
It's a huge problem. About 93% of fish populations are either overfished, which is about a third, or fished to their maximum capacity. So we have to figure out other ways to feed ourselves.
Yeah, it's part of extinction of species that we're...
Yeah.
We're seeing more and more on the lack of diversity now.
World War II created all this technology in terms of helicopters and radar and sonar and depth finders and all this stuff. And after the war, that was all shifted to be used for fishing. So we're actually using weapons of war to find and kill the last fish.
I never put that together before, that the military might then translates to fish fingers.
Yeah. Well, well, I don't know whether I'm helping by becoming a pescatarian.
It's a good step in the right direction.
I'm doing my best.
Those are her friends that
you're
eating.
Just don't eat any octopus, because they're probably smarter than all of us.
Oh, no.
They're the best.
Octopus? Yeah, that's a terrible feeling, isn't it? If you're like, does he know?
Oh, God. They're so cool.
You're holding your heart. Oh, you don't eat calamari.
That's a squid. They're not as smart.
Oh.
But I don't eat a lot of seafood, no.
Okay.
In my opinion, the most sustainable fish to eat are the tiny ones, the sardines and anchovies that are low on the food chain. They reproduce really quickly. They're more abundant. And they also have the highest levels of omega-3s and the lowest levels of toxins, because they don't live as long to accumulate all that mercury and PCBs and heavy metals. So there's a win-win for human health and fisheries when you think about eating tiny fish, but also eating farmed things that don't need to be fed wild things. So right now, the way that fish farming is done, salmon farming, you're often catching wild fish to feed the farmed fish, and it can be really polluting on the environment. But on the flip side, there's a really good way to do aquaculture, and I think we're going to be talking about that next.
Our final mother this show is somebody, Ayana, that you know. So she's here to help us understand more about how the oceans can look after us, even as we fail to look after them. She's an underwater farmer. Welcome, Jill Pegnataro.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. You guys know each other already?
So we just met today, but I am very familiar with GreenWave, the organization that she works for, and I'm an enormous fan. Like, awkward
fan. Thank you. And at GreenWave, we look up to you very much, Ayana. So thank you so much for inviting
me. This is a mutual fan club here.
Oh, yes.
Very awkward love fest.
Yes, yes, very much.
Welcome, Jill. And I think you'll have to tell the rest of us about your GreenWave 3D model.
Sure. So at GreenWave, we're here building the next generation of restorative ocean farmers.
The emphasis on restorative.
Exactly. So what that means is it's a polyculture farm, which means you have multiple species, and that increases...
And they can date whoever they want.
Exactly. And what these species are doing is shellfish, they're eating the zooplankton and the phytoplankton that are in the water column. And they're filtering the water.
And also, the shellfish are at the bottom?
The shellfish can be at the bottom in cages. Mm-hmm. You can have mussels grown in socks, which is basically a mesh net that's long and can hang from a line. And you can have scallops and lanterns, which is basically a basket divided and have scallops throughout it. There's a whole bunch of different options for farmers to diversify their farms.
The fish farming we hear about, it's one species, isn't it? And they...
Yeah, so we're not growing fish on our farms at all. It's all shellfish and seaweeds. So we're growing sugar kelp on our farm. And sugar kelps are restorative because they're actually absorbing the carbon that's in the water.
So you don't actually need any fertilizer. You don't need to feed this stuff. It just grows.
There are zero inputs to it, which is one of the reasons why it's so sustainable. No fertilizers, no additives. It's simply using what's in the water column to grow nutritious and sustainable food.
So help us like see even better, like what does it look like? So you described there's like cages on the bottom for clams. There's like mussels growing on ropes,
socks
hanging in the water. You've got
Is this in a kind of pool area or is it way out in the ocean?
So it's usually on a shellfish plot, which is about 20 to 30 feet deep, and you can usually see the shore from where it is, so it's not too far away.
Do you need to get a boat out there?
Yes. So to start our regenerative farms, we say that you should have a 20-acre plot on the ocean, $20,000, and a boat.
So only $20,000?
I don't know how much it would be to set up a farm on land, but it would be...
Oh, gosh.
A lot more.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. So it's cost effective. People can start a shellfish or a seaweed farm much more easily than a land-based farm. And you're also thinking about, in climate change with a food crisis in the future, how are we going to find new ways to grow food? Mm-hmm. And this regenerative, restorative model is really a way to grow nutritious food while also giving back to the oceans.
Wait, is the food the... Seaweed?
The shellfish. Yeah, yeah. They're both. Shellfish are high in protein, a delicacy. And seaweed is high in vitamins and minerals.
And protein.
And
seaweeds,
sugars.
Too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I didn't know it had protein.
Yeah. So one of the things that I learned from GreenWave was that farming in the ocean, it's three dimensions. It's not just the land. And so you can farm at all these different depths. And so you can create just like an insane amount of food out of a small area.
So in southern New England, if you have a 200-foot kelp line, you can get 4 to 6 pounds per foot on that line. So you'd have anywhere from 800 to 1,200 pounds of seaweed.
There's a lot of iodine in seaweed, which is a nutrient that a lot of people are deficient in these days because we're not eating as much fish and other things.
And who are the farmers that are doing this now? I mean...
So we have a farmer and training program. Mm-hmm. It's a 2-year program based in southern New England. And we work one-on-one with farmers through the entire process of permitting. We show them how to seed and how to harvest, how to set up their gear, and provide the seed from our hatchery for the first 2 years of their operation.
So do you have any graduates yet, or you're still new?
We do have some graduates from our farmer and training program, and we're still working with them, and we're using their farms to collect water quality data, and we're doing that to sort of pinpoint the exact temperature that you want to seed or when exactly you want to harvest. So coming up with that information and them helping us with
data. I was amazed to read that this is one of the 25 best inventions of 2017, according to Time magazine.
That's cool.
Yeah, they've been winning a lot of awards.
I think because the model is easy to replicate, you know, cost efficient.
And it addresses something we have to address, food security.
Exactly. Yeah.
And do it in a sustainable, restorative way.
The thing that I find really fascinating about this in terms of diet and climate is I recently learned that a diet that includes shellfish can actually have a lower carbon footprint than being purely vegan because it's such an efficient way to produce protein.
To get your protein.
Yeah. And so that I was relieved to hear because I do like eating oysters.
Do you grow
oysters? Frites. I mean, come on, let's live a little.
We do grow oysters. Yeah, our farm has oysters and sugar kelp. It's located in the Thimble Islands in Branford, Connecticut, and it's a fully functioning ocean farm, and we actually teach our farmers in training out there. It's our floating classroom. To make the biggest impact on the environment, we're looking to help people all across the country. So sort of a goal of GreenWave is to expand to 10 different regions in the U.S. In the next 5 years, and that equates to 500 restorative ocean farms in the water. And something that we've noticed recently is actually women coming up and becoming leaders in this industry. And so ways that we're helping to support them through farming, but also in our newsletter, we've created Who Farms Matters page, and we're sort of highlighting the women that we work with and listening to their stories and seeing how they envision this kelp industry and how they want it to be.
Very
and
cool.
Can this be replicated elsewhere in the world?
Yeah, so it definitely has to do with where the seaweeds can grow, what water temperatures. Our kelp that we grow is sugar kelp, and it likes cold waters. So it's...
Well, luckily there's a lot of different kinds of seaweed out there.
Yes, there is.
I'm really interested in the connections between farming on land and farming on sea. And I know that there's two ways specifically for that connection to happen in a really positive way. One is feeding seaweed to animals, and another is using seaweed as fertilizer. So I'd love to hear more about those things.
Sure. So there's definitely a market for seaweed and animal feed. They've done studies where they found that, I believe the type of seaweed is Asparagopsis, where they're...
I love a good Latin name.
This one in particular is great for... cattle, and they're finding that it can reduce the amount of methane that they produce by over 50%.
Because it's easier for them to digest or something?
I'm not
entirely makes them less gassy.
Sore.
They don't burp as much when they eat seaweed.
And I can't believe it.
Like half as much.
It's a very small percentage that's added into the feed that's actually able to make a difference.
I think they discovered that maybe even in Ireland, there were some fields where cows were grazing on the coast, and after storms, all the seaweed would wash up, and then they would notice that their digestion was different.
Really?
Yeah, seaweed has been used for centuries for feeding cattle and other livestock.
And what about fertilizer?
And fertilizer. So because of the nutrient value in kelp, it's able to absorb from the water column, makes for a great fertilizer as well. And so that kind of closes the cycle by using the kelp that we're growing in the oceans to fertilize these farms. And then it washes back and it's able to reabsorb the kelp.
So does your mother use seaweed?
She does. She puts a little bit of it in her chicken feed.
Has the World Bank been studying your actual GreenWave 3D model?
They've just done a global assessment of the potential of this kind of ocean farming.
So one of the figures that the World Bank came up with was that if we do kelp aquaculture in 5% of U.S. waters, it can sequester 350 million tons of carbon within a year, which is about, I believe, 3.2% of the carbon that's absorbed into the oceans.
That's very impressive.
The bank also said that by creating these farms in 5% of U.S. waters, we could create 50 million new jobs. So like I was saying,
that'd be the add-on jobs.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So every part of the industry that's contributing to local economies.
That'd be like those people who make the little shucking knives for oysters.
Yeah, there are a lot of pearl jobs.
Designers.
I'm just wondering, I was asking you about whether it could be replicated outside the United States. And you were saying, you know, basically what you're doing needs cold water. But, you know, is it possible to think of examples for, you know, tropical climates, you know, the developing country ideas? Because they need, you know, the replicable restorative food production.
Yes, they are growing in tropical areas, but just different types of seaweed.
What I'm really impressed by is that there are no inputs into it. There's no fertilizer.
Yes,
there's nothing going in that's...
You just need light, right?
Light, yeah, they live off of sunlight. The kelp does. The oysters are able to filter feed. And an adult oyster can filter up to 50 gallons a day. Yeah.
And they look like they're doing nothing.
They're just little shells.
Hanging out.
They're actually so busy.
Yeah, they need a little love and care, but yes. Mm-hmm, yeah.
No, it's just such a good idea.
Mary's about to buy stocks from you.
Yeah.
Well, speaking as a pescatarian.
Yes.
Is there a way to support your nonprofit?
I believe there are ways to donate on our website, www.greenwave.org.
What do you mean, I believe? Of course you
know. There are.
Greenwave.org, give them all your money.
www.greenwave.org. And our newsletter, you can sign up for our newsletter and learn about Who Farms Matters.
Great. Yes. Well, thank you so much for your expertise and your insight.
Yes.
It's so fascinating.
Yeah.
So
thank you very much, Jill. Yeah. It's really impressive.
Thank you for having me.
And I love the idea, Who Farms Matters.
Yes, who farms matters.
And how they farm matters.
Yes.
Yeah, great. Ayana, I'm going to take you up on what I feel is a little bit your resignation to the fact that we can't stay at 1.5. The scientists told us in the... the report on global warming needing to stay at 1.5, that it is doable. So, you know, you're a scientist. Are you contradicting all these scientists?
Oh, it's theoretically doable.
Well, they were saying more than theoretically. They were saying it's a matter of political will.
Exactly. That's the theory.
Yeah.
It's scientifically, we could do it.
And we must.
But will we?
Well...
It just remains to be seen, right?
If mothers of invention take over the world, we will.
Oh, for sure. When that happens, I will have no more concerns about the ability to stay at 1.5 degrees centigrade.
Ayana, we'd love to thank you for being our guest Mother of Invention host.
Thanks for having me. It's been a blast.
You adapted very quickly to our rather crazy style here.
We all have to be adaptive in this day and age.
True. Where can people find you and your work?
You can find out more about Ocean Collective at oceancollective.co. There's no E at the end of collective because that's actually a heavy metal band in Australia. So no E in my version of Ocean Collective.
Yes, because the way I saw it, I was like Ocean Collective.
Yeah, no, it's not hip. It just was already taken.
Okay.
And then all of my writing is on ayanaelizabeth.com.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Fantastic. We're also so interested to know what you, our listeners, would like to hear more about. We already asked for and received lots of great suggestions on our social media feeds for women who should be recognised as mothers of invention. So keep up the nominations. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram at Mothers Invent.
Mothers of Invention is a production of Doc Society, and it's made possible by the support of our partners, the Climate Justice Resilience Fund, the Compton Foundation, the Wallace Global Fund, the Children's Investment Fund Foundation, and the European Climate Foundation, and of course, our loyal DRIP crowdfunders.
Our series producer is Somali Kadikara. The executive producers are Jess Search and Beanie Finzi. Our audio producer and sound wizard is Anne Pope, and Jay DeSanta is our ace researcher. Namitha Veer Chopra produced our piece on former President Nasheed in the Maldives.
Aisha Yunus is our social media magician. Our climate expert consultants are Iris Andrews, Ed King and Catherine Wilkinson. Our theme music is Water Fountain by Toon Yards with kind permission from 4AD and Marriage Records.